ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
because Prabhupada in the purport, in the last verse, remarked that all questions regarding the universe and reality can be answered in Srimad Bhagavatam, so he says,
yeah.
It's the answer to all questions. So this begins hearing Atra in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There, and now here's the list. Huh? You can see in the word for word, Sarga. Statement of the creation of the universe. Visargaha is sub-creation or the secondary creation, the one by Brahma. Cha means also. Stanam. Here is called the planetary systems. Or you notice how this differs, the planetary system in the word for word and planetary system here, same one. Oh, I know what it is. We have these same two verses, the first two verses, chapters, are also translated, commented on in Chaitanya Charitamrita. This is Adi Lila, second chapters, 91 and 92. See, the same verses are quoted here. And sometimes you get interest in, Sarga, the creation of the ingredients of the universe. Visarga, the creations of Brahma, that those things which are done by Lord Brahma. First, the agent of the first creation is the first Purusha avatar. And then the second creation is Brahma. Stanam, the maintenance of the creation, the planetary systems, everything. What happens in a way between Sarga or Srishti and Pralaya. So there's the Sarga, Visarga, Stanam, and that they're in the Roda, the winding up, the middle period. That's what's meant by Stanam. Stiti, it's also called Stiti in the later version of Bhagavatam. Poshanam. Here, the favoring of the Lord's devotees. And in the Bhagavatam, how does he say it?
Protection.
Yeah. And protection by the Lord. And the Lord's special care for the devotees is Poshanam. Utaya. The creative impetus, which is also can be translated as impetuses for activity. Now, what these mean will be explained in a few next verses. Huh? Then, manu antara. Now, literally, Manu Antara means the reign of the Manu, of the Manus. As we all should know, how many Manus are there in a day of Brahma?
14.
Huh? 14 Manus in a day of Brahma? Is that right? Okay.
72 human cycles.
Huh?
72 human cycles.
They last as long as 71 Yuga cycles. Right? 14 mantras in the day of Brahma. For each one, actually, 70, multiply that out and you'll find there's 1,000 yugas, there's 994.
I thought it was 71 and a half.
No, I know the answer, I'll tell you later. No, it's 71.
Oh, I think I know the answer.
So you can say that right now. But here Prabhupada concentrates on what he calls prescribed duties given by Manus. And each one of these, the Manus hands down the Manu Samhita, the law books, the prescribed duties of mankind. So usually here in these translations, Prabhupada talks about that. Although, you'll find that this Puranic has a list of all the Manus in here. Like descriptions of what many of them do, and who they are, and who their sons are, and all those things, right? Chiefly in the 8th canto. Yeah. But here, in this one, he calls it changes of Manus. The changes of Manus. So both two aspects of the Manvantara. Antara means a period. Just a period of Manu. Then the next one is Isha Anukata, the science of God, he calls it here. What does he call it here? He calls it a description of the incarnations of the Lord. Well, it's really a description of the Lord, or that counts of the Lord, huh? Nirodha. Now here, very interestingly, Prabhupada calls Nirodha, going back home, back to Godhead. I don't know where that comes from, because later on it's described as, in the second canto, 10th chapter, as the winding up of creation. This is a verse that defines each one of these. And there's a commentary on just what it is. So I don't know exactly. I mean, in a sense, with the winding up of the individual bonding with material existence is Nirodha, but here it's called, see in the Adi Lila, it's called the winding up of creation. Then Muktihi, liberation. That's the other topic. And then finally, Ashraya, the ultimate shelter, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ashraya means shelter. Then, okay, so here we go, we have it here. Here he describes Ashraya as the summum bonum. Here Prabhupada harks back to the beginning of Bhagavatam, as the absolute truth. And so he uses this Latin phrase. You know what summum bonum means in English? Anyone know?
The ultimate summum?
No. The highest good. Bonum is good. Summum is the greatest good. So then the next text goes on, after listing these 10 topics or he covered in Srimad Bhagavatam, it says, the 10th, Dasyamasya, the Dasya, is the 10th one, that is to say, the Summum Bonum. Well, it says, the other nine, are described in order to distinguish or to isolate the summum bonum. So they're distinguished. You may remember, in I guess the first or the second verse of the Bhagavatam, in the purport, Prabhupada talks about substance and categories. Well, what he means to say is the summum bonum is the substance, and everything else, the categories, is that which proceed from the substance. In some kind of European philosophical language somewhere, substance and categories. But that's what it means. So there's the summum bonum, which is the tenth, and the other nine are described to distinguish it. This is the isolated. To distinguish it, distinguish the summum bonum from all others. The way Prabhupada translates it here, well, let's look at it. I like this translation as it's given here, the first one. He does the first and the second together. Here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10 subjects are described. This is the Adi Lila, second chapter. One, the creation of the ingredients of the cosmos. Two, the creations of Brahma. Three, the maintenance of creation, as Stana. Four, special favor given to the faithful, Hosanna. Five, impetuses for activity. Six, prescribed duties for law-abiding men, as Manu Antara. Seven, description of the incarnations of God, Isha Anupata. Eight, the winding up of the creation. Nine, very precisely here, liberation from gross and subtle material existence. In other words, every time we die, we are liberated from the gross body, but because we are not liberated from the subtle body, we come back. So the trick is to be liberated from the subtle body. And Kapila Dev says in the next canto, devotional service dissolves the subtle body of the living entity. So it's liberation from both gross and subtle. That's why Prabhupada puts it this way, mukti. And 10, the ultimate shelter. This is Ashraya. Supreme Personality of Godhead. The 10th item is the shelter of all others. I'll explain what's meant by shelter. To distinguish this ultimate shelter from the other 9 subjects, the Mahajanas have described these 9, and then directly or indirectly, through prayers or direct explanations. Now, between these 2 versions, there's a difference, but Shrutena, by prayers, and the other ones, I think, is by scriptures. Artena, by Artha, explanation, and also Anjasa, which usually means straight, quickly, directly. We've got a little different way of dealing with it here in this one. Shrutena by Vedic evidence, by an arti called direct explanations, anjasa summarily. So I suppose different acharyas have glossed these, read these a little differently. But anyway, you get the idea. So this is the topic. The 9 are there, and then finally the 10th, which is the summum bonum. And these are the topics that are included here in this Bhagavatam. Now this goes on. Here, see, in text 3, we start to define them. Yeah.
What it means in the second text. To distinguish, they describe the 9. Yes? But how they distinguish by this 10th, by describing the 9?
Well, it says the 9 are described in such a way as to make it clear how they differ from the 10th.
So they describe in relationship.
Yeah. Here, let's go to the other thing. The Prabhupada explains this. We'll go to it right away. We can here's here in the purport, Prabhupada has described the given longer definitions of these, but I will just go to this part here. Two different principles are to be considered herein, namely Ashraya, right? That's the tenth, it's called Ashraya. The object providing shelter, and Ashrita, the dependence requiring shelter. The Ashrita exists under the original principle, the Ashraya. The first nine categories described in the first nine cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, from creation to liberation, including the Purusha avatars, the incarnations, the marginal energies, energy or living entities, the external energy or the material world, all are ashrita. So even Isha Anukuta is in the category of ashrita because it describes the different incarnations who are incarnations of Krishna, who is not an incarnation but the source of all incarnations. The prayers, The prayers of Srimad Bhagavatam, however, aim for the Ashraya Tattva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, the great souls expert in describing Srimad Bhagavatam have very diligently delineated the other nine categories, sometimes by direct narration and sometimes by indirect narration such as stories. The real purpose of doing this is to know perfectly the absolute transcendent Sri Krishna, where the entire creation, both material and spiritual, rests on the body of Sri Krishna. Can I explain it for you?
So, here again, this is the thing that they describe in mind. But by describing, it is done to know the absolute transcendence. But how by describing others?
Because you describe the nine as being derived from their ashrita. They're derived from, dependent on, in service of the tenth. So they're all described as that way.
So it would be inaccurate to say that Vishnu is independent?
Vishnu is
independent? Is it inaccurate understanding?
If you read the early chapters of Chaitanya Charitamrita, it describes how all the different expansions, even Lord Balaram, they all worship Lord Krishna. Even though, in a sense, they are non-different, still they know they are derived from or proceed from the Lord. He said, this is clear about this issue on a Anukata. That's why you have this verse, Ete Chamsakala Purusan Krishna Sti Bhagavan Swayam. All these are either Kala or Amsha, but Krishna's Bhagavan Swayam. He's distinguished from them as being not a Kala or an Amsha, but Bhagavan Swayam. Nevertheless, they're Vishnu Tattva. They are non-different. They're not different, and they're non-different. But in all of those, Krishna is described as the original. And different examples are given, but he's described as the original. Krishna, of course, in the Bhagavatam, there are arguments for why Krishna is supreme. It's not just that we say it because he's our favorite, but there's arguments. And the main argument that I remember from the Bhagavatam, the direct argument, is inciting the sages at Dandakaranya Forest who could not enjoy a conjugal relationship with Ramachandra because he was limited in the amount of relationships he could have. And so they had to wait for Krishna in order to fulfill their desires. So in the other avatars, expansions, it's not that they aren't plenary, that is in full power, but not everything is manifest in them. Now the other argument for explaining how Krishna is supreme, this to me is a very convincing argument, is that there's one Lord, but there are not many gods. There's one. But what they are, the same Lord has many different relationships with different devotees, and therefore is manifest differently. He does it simultaneously. Sometimes we have many different relationships with different kinds of people, and we do it sequentially. We can't do it all at once. Because sometimes Prabhupada uses this example of a judge in the court. When he's on the bench with his black robes and maybe a ridiculous wig, everybody has to say, "Your Honor, if it pleases the court." But then he changes clothes and goes out with his friends. And even if it's the same lawyer, they have a very different relationship. He dresses differently, he talks differently. So you be staying in sequence a number of different relationships where our language is different, our dress is different, our behavior is different, our association is different. Maybe we belong to a secret club where a man dresses up in women's clothes, you don't know. Or mild-minded stockbrokers, you know, pick up guitars and play heavy metal rock. these things happen. So these are different relationships, because God has so many devotees and so many different relationships. He does these all at once. But the one who has what Krishna represents is really the private life of God. It's the same as Vishnu, but Vishnu is formal and official. But Krishna is his private life. What does the Queen of England do when she's not playing at being the Queen? That's her private life. Otherwise, you meet her at court, and you have to say Your Majesty, and you have to genuflect, or bow, or curtsy, and all that stuff, and treat her with great respect and formality. And if you're received at court, you made it. You know, you're like a big thing. You've been received at court, given some recognition, knighted or something, Sir Ringo, or whatever the Beatles were. But if somehow or other you are so well connected that you're received at home, you sit with the royal family around the breakfast table playing with the corgi dogs and whatever else, then you're really in. That's higher. See, although Krishna is more informal and relaxed, it doesn't mean he's less than the majesty of Vaikuntha. This is his private life with his intimate associates. He's God, but nobody cares about that. He does that over there somewhere. They love him because he's Krishna. They don't care that he's God. Every so often it occurs to them, they say, "Oh, cool," then they forget about it. That's what happens with that. So therefore, that's higher. Otherwise, everybody wants to know. There's this TV series in America, The Private Lives of the Rich and Famous. Everybody's curious to know. They got these obnoxious photographers taking pictures of the royal family with telephoto lenses. You know, everybody wants to know their private life, but you're excluded. They tried to anyway, unless you're very well connected. That's the argument why Krishna is the highest.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question. At one time, the Lord told me that the Krishna local planet, sometimes we have this conception that, you know, there's millions of, but like look at the last planets, and then there's one planet called the Krishna local planet. But there's one devotee once told me, and I want to see if this is true or not, that actually the Krishna local planet, there are more people or more souls relating to Krishna in that planet than there are in all the Vaikuntha planets. Is that true?
I've never heard that. I've never heard a soul count.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are the previous nine chapters interdependent from
the tenth?
Sorry, not chapters, cantos.
Are they?
They're much independent, I mean, interdependent from the tenth? Or is that the tenth stand in itself on its own above, supreme above all others?
Well, in order to appreciate the tenth for what it is, you have to have understood the previous nine. First, you have to you have to understand who Krishna is. You have to understand this idea that he is, in fact, the summum bonum. And enter into the proper relationship to him as master and servant. And then you can forget. So the people who try to not bother with the other nine and just go to the tenth, so of course Prabhupada rejects this approach. So the other nine there are for the purpose, so you can understand the complete science, the complete understanding of what it means to say Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all those details and just what is entailing. Because first you have to surrender to Krishna. And then, after surrendering, a relationship develops. Then in the intimacy of that relationship, then it's not exactly that you don't know that Krishna is God, you just don't care. It's just not of interest. There's other things about him that are so much more amazing than the fact that he's God. I mean, the fact that he's God, you know, has so much power and everything, that's already mind-boggling. But there's something else that's so even more spectacular that happens when you makes all that look like nothing. You can just imagine. You know, this is the place where all the building stones of Chintamani and all the trees in the forest are kapha vrikshas and all the cows are surabhi cows and all the village girls are lakshmis. It's just the beginning. And nobody cares that they're that. And so this is his position. Prabhupada mentions here, we have these nine topics. And you may notice, like, if you pull down the contents little flap here and you go to Srimad Bhagavatam, you see the titles of the things? So, Canto 1, Creation. Sarga. 2, the Cosmic Manifestation, the Sarga. Stanam gets translated as the status quo and why. I don't know for the life of me. Oceanum was translated as the creation of the fourth order. I didn't even know what that means. What's the fourth order? Maybe. But where's that in that canto even?
Isn't it the canto with...
Well, it's got all kinds of things in there, you can see. But I don't know what's the creation of the fourth order in there. Maybe, I don't know, the activities of the Pachakas? But how is that Poshanam? I mean, in a sense, that's a topic there. There's Daksha's sacrifice story. There's the Dhruva Maharaj story. So these are all stories of the favor of the love for the devotees. and the Lord toward the devotees. King Venu, Ritu.
King Garanjana.
I don't know. Maybe you can look it up and see what the titles are. But anyway, it's called Creation of the Fourth Order. That's the one that's not intuitive and obvious why that means. The creative impetus, that's Uti. Prescribed duties for mankind, Manu, Manvantara. The science of God, Ishanupata. Withdrawal of the cosmic creations, the Nirodha. Liberation, Mukti, and the Summum Bonum. So these cantos are titled that way. Now, things don't line up quite that neatly, you know, there's not all these topics only restricted to each canto, but that's how they title them. And the last two are sort of supplementary to these 10 topics. Yes?
This status quo being the translation
of that? Status quo means the situation now. The current situation is the meaning of the status quo. And so he uses that as the translation of sthana, the middle stable period between creation and destruction. Yeah?
Just looking in front of me, a quote from 12th canto, chapter 7, 6 to 11. And it says that Srila Jiva Goswami has explained that the 10 principal topics of Srimad Bhagavatam are found within each of the 12 cantos. One should not try to assign each of the 10 topics to a particular canto.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It looks like for some reason we have that.
I just think this is a kind of ceremonial way of titling the cantos.
Is it
Prabhupada? Huh?
Or it's,
no, I think it's before Prabhupada. Prabhupada didn't do this. I'm pretty sure that this is a traditional way of doing it.
Plus, a genuine statement is what it means is that you can't. Just what you said before. That these may be general.
General things, but it's not. You usually find these things in that chapter, but it's certainly not the only thing.
And Jiva Goswami makes the point that the 10 topics are found in the chapter Shloki itself.
Yeah. So. I mean, in the Canto 1, you don't see much about Sarga either. It all shows up in Canto 2. You see what I mean? But I just think it's a kind of a way of celebrating the 10 topics. Srimad Bhagavatam, or commemorating them or something like that, by giving titles to the chapters like that.
There's nobody who made this analysis. In regard to this 10 topics, which chapter is.
What did you say?
Is there somebody who did this, this analysis of this 10 of the whole 12 cantos in regard to this 10 topics?
I don't know how they got that way. I have no idea. I just wanted to show you that they are.
But I mean, in reality, if it is done or not. I mean, to show particular.
No, I don't know of any.
Jiva Goswami,
and Jiva Goswami says, don't do it.
Well, but what he does do is he takes the first verse of Bhagavatam, which shows how each word corresponds to one of these things. He takes the chapter Shloki and says that each of the 10 topics are found in the form in the chapter Shloki.
But he says he should not do it.
But he said, what he says is that don't expect that the only thing you'll find in the first canto is Sarga. The only thing you'll find.
You don't hardly find Sarga in the first canto.
You find it in the first verse, but.
Yeah, that's it. You know, the rest goes on to other things, you know. The history of the Bhagavatam, Maharaj Pariksit. The whole story is right there. You don't know why it's. It has a purpose for being in there, but. The whole story is in there about Draupadi and the whole incident with what to do with Ashwatthama, which is more like Poshanam.
Yeah,
So here now, let's go and look at these, the definitions of these. The Prabhupada has them in the purport here in this, and we'll go to the bottom of this. Here we go. So this one, now first one, this one requires Bhuta, Matra, Indriya, Diyam, Janma. Sarga Udarita. Sarga means the creation of the Bhutas, the five of those elements. Matra, the Tan Mantra, is the object perceived by the senses. And Indriya, the senses, and Diyam, the creation of the mind, too. The element creation of the six items of matter, namely the five elements, sound, form, taste, smell, touch, and the eyes, ear, nose, tongue, skin, and mind, is known as Sarga. Here, Sarga, here means now in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Sarga, Prabhupada summarizes as the first creation by Vishnu. The bringing forth of the five gross material elements, the five objects of sense perception, the ten senses, the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, and the total material energy, or universal form. That's Sarga. I think I've got a little thing here. Maybe it's in this one. Let's see. Yeah, here you can see, this is Sarga, really, is these things here. The Pradana, the Mahatattva, then there's Ahankarat, then Hankarat. This is all from the third canto. But this is what ends up as Sarga. Vaikarika, which means out of the transformation, the mode of goodness, is mind and the devatas. Devatas in some as powers or something before they're really working, because everything else has to be. Then out of the mode of passion, buddhi, and the gyanindriya, so the knowledge acquiring senses. And then the karmindriya, the active senses, speech, touch, walking, so on. But it's mentioned that prana is the backup force for them in the same way that buddhi is for the knowledge acquiring senses. But prana, this should be in brackets because it's not really listed as an element. But it's mentioned in the third canto as being there. But prana is obviously some form of air, so. Anyway, then in the mode of ignorance, tamasa, transformation, there these are the tanmatra, mean the sense objects, sound, objects of touch, form, odors and taste and odors, and then this is the panchamahabhuta, these five here. This is as good. So that's really Sarga. That's physics.
This
is Sanskrit. I just put them in Sanskrit. Shrota means the sense of hearing. Ears. Twak, the sense of touch. Chakshus, the eye, the sense of seeing. Rasana, the sense of taste. And Grahana, the sense of smell. I just put these are Sanskrit words for these.
Tamasa, and then you said Rajasa?
Yeah, in the third canto, the transformation mode of goodness is called Vaikarika. And transformation mode of passion is called Tejasa, and mode of ignorance is called Tamasa. I don't know why the difference in terminology, but that's. But the things that are in bold are really what's created these, that's the, you know, if you count them up, 5, 10, 15, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. There they are.
This is the Vedic periodic table, right?
More or less, yeah.
In the Bhagavad Gita, when the elements are listed, it seems to be like they're from gross to subtle.
Yeah.
And so mind usually comes before intelligence as seeming to be more gross.
It is.
But here, manas is coming from a remote of goodness.
Yeah.
Buddhi is coming from a remote of passion.
Isn't that interesting? And Ahankara is way up here before the mode. Because these are three divisions of Ahankara. But you should understand this, although we want to go from the middle platform to the platform of Buddhi. My understanding is that Buddhi's main function, as Kapila Devi explains, it helps the knowledge acquiring senses to work. So it's connected with the activities of the senses. And the activities and the senses themselves are created out of the mode of passion. And they couldn't work. The knowledge acquiring senses couldn't work without Buddhi. Because Buddhi governs recognition, for example. Whereas manas, if the mind is in its pure state, then you can understand Krishna. The yoga system focuses on the mind. And the intelligence is used to purify the mind. And when the mind is pure, then it's... can recognize transcendence. Also, later on in this chapter, the same division will show up under the name as this first one here, over here, and this one is Adidaivika. This one here, Adiatmika, and this one here, Adibhautika. Or Adi Buddha.
Sometimes when I hear something springs from the mode of ignorance, I get a little confused because, for example, Shabda is sound. And sound is like a very, very subtle.
It's the subtle form of the subtlest element, which is ether.
Yeah. So I
see, it comes down from subtle to gross.
But I'm just trying to say, just because something springs from the mode of ignorance doesn't mean that it's in the mode of ignorance.
No, it's a transformation of the mode of ignorance. But it's gross matter and the objects of perception. It's what gives you the body, which we know is gross. It's gross. Okay. Anyway, I don't mean to add, but this is sarva. That's what's created in sarva. It's really our version of physics. Visarga, the secondary creation, or the work of Brahma in producing the moving and unmoving bodies in the universe, Brahmanda. And so here also, come back to here. Visarga is here, Prabhupada describes it as recreation. And Parusha. See, subsequent results in interaction. The way Visarga Purusha Smitaha is the work of the one who comes from the Purusha, who is the first Purusha. Well, anyway, Prabhupada explains all this here. The original creation is directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead or Param Brahman, and the secondary creation as a reactionary result of the original ingredients is made by Brahman. thus the activities of the whole universe are started. So this is how the creation story happens. And we've already got it in this canto. Stiti is another way of saying sthana. And here it's defined as Vaikuntha Vijaya. The victory, Vaikuntha here means the Lord of Vaikuntha. You can do that in Sanskrit. Vaikuntha means he who has, or is the Lord of Vaikuntha. Vijaya means the victory of the Lord of Vaikuntha. In other words, in the sthana, that means the maintenance by Vishnu. This is the time when Vishnu is clearly predominating over Brahma and Shiva. Brahma is in his own in the beginning, in the Visarga. Shiva is on his own. We've already had that verse. Remember, in the beginning, there is Lord Brahma and the Prajapatis. In the middle, there is Vishnu and the Manus and the Rajarshis. And in the end, there is Lord Shiva and the atheist full of anger. So that's why this sthana, the maintenance of the period of maintenance, is called Vaikuntha Vijaya. Although here Prabhupada wants to emphasize another aspect of that, the right situation. Because stiti is another way. Like we say somebody is well situated, we do that in English. The right situation for a living entity is to obey the laws of the Lord and thus be in perfect peace of mind under the protection of the personality of Godhead. So there he just moves right, segues right into posana and calls it maintenance. Here, Prabhupada has been more analytical in his presentation. Sthana, the maintenance of the universe by the personality of Godhead, Vishnu. Vishnu's function is more important and his glory greater. See, this is the Vaikuntha Vijaya. Vishnu's function is more important and his glory greater than Brahma's and Lord Shiva. Because although Brahma is the creator and Lord Shiva is the destroyer, Vishnu is the maintainer. So therefore, this Prabhupada is explaining really Vaikuntha Vijaya. And then Poshana, what it says in the Sanskrit is Tat Anugraha. It means the Lord's mercy. The Lord's mercy. Tat Anugraha has caused this mercy. And so Prabhupada explains this. Poshana, special care and protection for devotees by the Lord. As the king maintains his kingdom and subjects, but nevertheless gives special attention to the members of his family. For the personality of Godhead gives special care to his devotees who are souls completely surrendered to him. Okay. And then Uti, impetus is, I think this is in a different sequence here, let's see. They give them, here in this here, Manu, the Manu Antara, the reign of the Manus. Again, Prabhupada's, it's described as Sat Dharma. It's characterized by Sat Dharma, the right directions of life. Here, Prabhupada says, Manu and Vantara, the periods controlled by the Manus who teach regular principles for living beings who desire to achieve perfection in human life. The rules of Manu, as described in the Manu Samhita, guide the way to such perfection. I think in this little paper here I have, described the Yuga cycles. Then the Manvantaras. So a Manu, 71 Divya Yugas, or Yuga cycles. If you multiply 14 by 71, because there are 14 manus, you get 994. So where are the six missing yuga cycles? Well, what happens is the day of Brahma actually contains only 994 complete yuga cycles. The missing time, equal to the duration of six Divya Yugas, or six yuga cycles, is taken up by Sanjas. The Sanja is a juncture or a transitional period. For example, a day has three Sanjas, dawn, noontime, and dusk. As it says, Yasya Tri Sanja. Also, within the duration of each yuga, there's a beginning and an ending Sanja, each equal to a few hundred years of the gods. When we had the 500th anniversary of the appearance of Lord Chaitanya, the pundits here said that this is actually the beginning of the golden age of Lord Chaitanya, and the first 500 years was a Sanja, a dawn. So in 1986, the golden age began. There's Sanjas, okay? So there are Sanjas in connection with the Manvantaras. There's a Sanja before each Manvantara and one following the last. So there's 15 Sanjas, and each one's lasts 4/10 of a yuga cycle, which is the same as the length of one Satya Yuga. Yeah.
Where is it described?
I forgot where I got it from. Somewhere. It's described, I can't remember where it's described. I had a big discussion about Sadhguru about it. Prabhupada says that we should follow it, and I understand there's a whole school of Dharma Shastra that people study them and comment on them and so on. And I've been given to understand by Dr. Vidyapurna Maharaj and others that there's, first of all, a special way that the Manusamhita applies to Vaishnavas. And others have said that actually there's a modification for Kali Yuga in general.
Yeah. I think it's the Parashara Samhita, which says it lists the yugas that each Dharma Shastra is appropriate for. And it says that the Manusamhita is particularly for this.
Is for?
Satya Yuga.
Satya Yuga.
I mean, of course, it has universal principles in it.
So they're adapted in different ways for different, applied differently. Then I mentioned here this little summary. Each Manvantara brings a change of cosmic administration. New people occupy the post of seven sages, and the devat is headed by Indra. Each Manvantara is followed by a devastation, inundation up to Bhumandala. Up to Bhumandala.
Is the Earth planet? It's the Earth planet.
Huh?
Earth planet is not devastated.
No. But the lower water is moving into it. And here's a list. The incarnations of the Lord that appear in this Manvantara. Okay, so that's the Manvantara. The Uti, urges of creation or initiative power that is the cause of all inventions according to the necessities of time, space, and objects. What it says in the Sanskrit, Udayaha is karma vasanaha, the desire. Vasana is not exactly like a desire, actually. It's a deep inclination or predisposition to karma. as the impetus is for work, the fruit of work. Okay, so that's that one. The problem that you get here.
I was going to say that Prabhupada's wording of this, the right situation for the living entities is so great and possible, and must be in perfect peace of mind. Vishwamacharya Thakur gives a second meaning of Vaikuntha Vijaya, which means that the Lord conquers over the misery of the living entities.
That's nice. That's where he gets it from.
Peace of mind.
And Prabhupada has a long purport about the right way of work and what's sub-dharma. But we want to. So now the next part of the list, but let's take a break, huh? Take a 5 minute break and then we'll continue with this.
Victorious in the middle paragraph. Is that related in relation to why Lord Krishna appears in exactly 12 moon are in the day of the moon? So that's a smack right there.
I don't know.
Can't get any more middle than that.
I don't know. I don't know if every day of Ramani appears at the same time or not. I had a little EMJ or something, but I can't shut my mouth.
Oh, he's still in pain?
Yes, yeah, it started today while I was eating lunch all of a sudden.
Yes, I'm going to massage you.
No, I don't. When somebody goes out and you hit massages.
I know somebody I'll talk to.
No, because it's like really acute right now. It was not so bad, but all of a sudden just spraying and squeeing. Yeah, it's here. Like the whole side of my jaw is swollen, and I can't close my teeth either. It's called TMJ, temporal mandibular joint disorder. TMJ. It's an inflammation of this jaw joint. Yeah. The jaw. It's inflammation.
Special thanks in here to everything that I have to do down most of the information that's just about the piece.
Well, if you want me to, I'll do my bad admission.
Yeah, we can try that too.
Okay.
Well, the first time I had this was just before I came to India. I usually go to an acupuncturist anyway. And he put all these needles along here.
It was
amazing. It was great. But now it happened again, and he's in America, so.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it will take to go away.
I know there's one man here I know. I'll talk to him. He's good.
But my acupuncturist suggests we go to India, get somebody who gives a head massage. That's like a big thing in Bengal, right? Head massage. Bengalis do it. They gotta find somebody else they're doing it, and that probably will help. But you can feel like all the muscles up in here are very tight.
Yeah.
This is all swollen. You can feel it's like a little sore all through here.
Fly knuckles better than normal.
It's just like, really, I can't close my mouth. My teeth don't go together. My advice to you is don't grow old. Stop who you are.
Or die.
Here's a joke about two old guys meeting, and he says, "How are you?" He says, "Well, pretty well." They're hobbling around that question.
How are you? Pretty well, considering the alternative. So I suppose you can always look at it that way, huh? I heard there was a Russian proverb that's translated in English as live and scratch. When you die, the itching will stop. Yeah, I'm telling you, you get these books that have all these Russian live and scratch. When you die, the itching will stop. It doesn't stop though, it keeps on going. It's a little proverb. Yeah. It keeps on going. Another one in this book I had about claimed the Russian proverb said. Yeah, when I was a kid or something, said, that after you've had it for 7 years, you'll know what to do with it. Hey, you never heard that. Because you didn't wear a peasant or something.
Or maybe. But I mean, this is not really a contemporary proverb. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe from the 19th century, huh?
Yeah. You
I think along the Sagar and then Sanjus. Can I copy it?
Yeah, sure.
Very helpful. We'll put all this stuff in there on.
Yeah.
And this is next to him. Turn around the right way.
Nobody's so far systematized Bhagavad Gita, so we don't even know what the ten elements were situated.
The ten what?
Of the ten elements, where you find them, you know, like a structure of Bhagavad Gita, you know.
No, but they're really not like that, they're scattered all around. I mean, the next one, Isha Anupata. I kind of better close this one down. And we'll go on here. Yeah. What's your start for the money? That's what I have in here. I just go for it.
So the Sagar on the Gosa.
Huh?
Kelp has got the Sagar on the Gosa.
Yeah, that's at the top of the document.
This picture which you give the theory is based on all its you figure out
what?
This Sankhya.
No, that's right from the third canto. I just put it into a little chart.
You mean that there's a Sankhya in between of Mandatas?
No. That's a Sandhya.
Sandhya.
Yeah, the
not Sankhya in Sandhya.
Yes.
In between of
each. Yeah, I think I got it from Sariputta. He told me where he got it from, and I don't remember. Yeah. The Prabhupada mentions the Sanya in a few places.
Yeah,
even
here, there's
but you see, if you multiply 71 by 14, you come up 6 yuga cycles short.
Yeah.
So you need to explain it.
But the cycle of yuga. Anyway, but we even hear that there's a sandhya in between the yugas as well.
Like yeah, but that means that nothing happens. It's not that there's a real bad, but it's just really short.
You mean like one is decreasing and
there's a point where they join, but one is going down and then maybe there's some kind of cataclysm and then it's going up again.
But in between Manavadas, it's really long, saying that nothing's possible.
What?
In between the Manavadas.
The Manavadas is a devastation, although not between everyone. I think even there's some Prabhupada says
Sridhar Swami says one thing, and Yuga Goswami says something else about the devastation between the Manus. And the conclusion, I think Yuga Goswami's, I have to look it up, and you find it. And I know what the conclusion is now. Yeah, according to Sripad Sridhar Swami, this is 1.13.15, excuse me. There's not always a devastation after the change of every mind. But Sri Jiva Goswami has given definite proofs from authoritative scriptures like the Vishnu Damodara, Markandeya Purana, Harivansha, that there is always a devastation after the end of each and every manu. So that's the conclusion. Srila Vishnacharamurti has also supported Srila Jiva Goswami, and he, Sri Chakravarti, has also quoted from the Bhagavatamrita about the inundation after every manu. Okay?
I mean, they both right. You know, like when acharyas, approved acharyas become different opinions.
Well, usually if there seems to be some disagreement, usually the first thing you do, the rule is when you find some disagreement in Shastra, is you try to find a way to reconcile them. Now they're both true. Yeah. And then finally, you know, like in this case, because Jiva Goswami is working under the authority of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, one might think that he has superior information. And he quotes other Shastras too, that maybe Sridhar Swami didn't refer to, and so on. So,
at the same time, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu considered Sridhar Swami's comment.
He did. But that doesn't mean that, he was limited to.
And Jiva Goswami in the Sutta says in early on that he'll follow the commentary of Sridhar Swami insofar as it represents the pure Vaishnava Siddhanta. Uh-huh. Sort of implies that occasionally when Sridhar Swami is addressing, you know, it's sort of his own school, that he'll feel, you know, the freedom to go in a different direction.
Like the way to comment
is, in either case, you know how to go back to Godhead if you want to.
For sure.
Okay, so.
There's no answer to my question.
On that matter, there's not any confusion, huh? Now, the next one is. Now it's describing Isha Katha. Here it just calls it Isha Katha or Isha Anukatha. The science of God, as Prabhupada says here, is said to be the accounts of the activities of the Lord in His various avatars, as well as the activities of His great devotees. Anuvartana, those who are His followers. The persons who are His followers, Anuvartinam Bhumisam. So that includes, there are descriptions of Isha Anukatha, it's not just the activities of the Lord, but also His great devotees. So the Nisringa and Prahlad, Dhruva, Krishnagarbha, so this way the devotees are always there with this Isha Anukatha. In the CC, he describes it as scriptural information regarding the personality of God in His incarnations on earth and the activities of His devotees. Scriptures dealing with these subjects are essential for progressive human life. Then, Naroha.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess respond to this question about that.
Yeah, about the
Sridhar Swami presents it hypothetically. He says even if there isn't, still it could be answered that in this particular case.
Oh, I see.
So he's Sridhar Swami is fairly non-committal, and Jiva Goswami is not just to say, oh, no, there is every time. And
just so see, another doubt removed. Mm-hmm. Now you can surrender.
So that was early in the first canto. You haven't built up yet.
Yeah, as you mentioned it. Okay. So Sridhar tried to push it like that in a hypothetical way. Like he's not quite sure whether there is or isn't. Jiva Goswami says, yep, there definitely is. Okay. Prabhupada says, he talks about this Isha Anagata makes history worth reading. It's the history that's worth reading. Otherwise, history is not worth reading. According to him, it's the great devotees and the Lord that makes it. Because it says it should be remembered, always be remembered that the material creation is created for the salvation of the conditioned souls. Now, Nirodha, the winding up. I love this one, huh? The Anushayanam, the lying down of the Purusha incarnation of Mahavishnu in mystic slumber. Together with the living entities and the energies, the material energies. That's what that is. I think Jiva says the same thing. The winding up of all energies employed in creation. See, they the spider example, they unwind and they wind back up again. So they pop into being and pop out of being. They come out and they come back in. Such potencies are emanations from the personality of Godhead who eternally lies in the Karana ocean. The cosmic creations manifest with his breath are again dissolved in due course. When we come to Mukti, and this is a famous definition.
That would mean, but also like the time of nighttime of Brahma, when there's, that would also be in that category. It's like the morning of the partial.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There's also the road that is described that way. But it's not the total winding up, but partially. Brahma goes back into the lotus flower.
And he winds it up at the very end.
Yeah, this was really, I think, is talking about the very end of the life of Brahma. The universe is dissolved.
And he winds it up.
Because during the Brahma's night, It's not really the sarga that's not wound up. But here the sarga is wound up, so it's balanced with this with the sarga.
The living entities
are annihilated during Brahma's night.
Where do they go at that time?
They're not annihilated.
I mean, the bodies are not.
Yeah, they go back into the lotus flower. Yeah. And they come back out again. And when they come out, it's described they look bluish. Because they have their karma clinging. They still have their subtle bodies and their karma is clinging to them. Because of their contamination, they have a bluish hue. It's in Bhagavad, I forgot exactly where it was. Then here's Prabhupada quotes this next one, Muktiya Hitvanyata Rupam Swarupena Vyastitaha. This is the definition of Mukti. Liberation. The
giving up of the anyata rupam, you can say the extraneous form, and swarupena vyasrita, and becoming, returning to his permanent situation in his swarup, his real original form. There's the anyata rupam, the extraneous form, which Prabhupada calls the changeable, gross, and subtle material body. And in the permanent situation, the form of the living entities. Many times, Prabhupada quotes this. This is where it is. The definition of liberation. It's not dissolution, disappearance. It's real liberation. This is the Bhagavatam's own definition. It's not an impersonal idea. Liberation of the conditioned soul encaged by the gross and subtle coverings of body and mind, when freed from all material affection, the soul giving up the gross and subtle material body. As we mentioned, we get rid of gross bodies all the time, but because of material affection, the subtle body remains, clings to the soul because of not a false ego, and therefore acquires another gross body in the course of time. But when the soul gives up the gross and subtle material bodies, can attain the spiritual sky in his original spiritual body and engage in transcendental loving service to the Lord in Vaikuntha Loka or Krishna Loka. When the soul is situated in his original constitutional position of existence, he is said to be liberated. It is possible to engage in transcendental loving service to the Lord and become Jivan Mukta, a liberated soul, even while in the material body. Because a person, like for example, one who's fully liberated soul has two existences. This body, which is practicing as a devotee, known as the Sadhaka Deha, which is fully engaged in Krishna service. And there's a siddha deha in the spiritual world. He's there in both places. We mentioned that. The question comes up. I think it's in Baladeva Vibhushana commentary. Which one? Vedanta Sutra. I forgot I read it. He says, he answers the questions that actually when a soul becomes liberated, then the karma is all gone, then immediately he should leave his body. Because the body and mind is just going on by your past karma. So that's finished when you're liberated, utterly finished. So they should just go. And you return on back to Godhead. But we have Jivan Mukta. We see that there are liberated souls on earth. How does that happen? And Baladeva says that they are not going on by their karma. Krishna keeps them going. Krishna directly keeps their bodies going and everything. Otherwise, if he did not do that, there would be no great souls on the planet to help other people. You know what this is? Anyway, I don't know. That's his answer to that question. How can there be Jivan Mukti if there's no more karma? So those devotees, their bodies are simply directly, they're not going on by karma anymore. They're going on by Krishna's desire. Okay, those are the 10 topics. Let's see what Prabhupada says in this book here. Here he talks about the two types of living entities, nityamuktas, nityabhagas, and so on, and the point of the existence. Okay, now he says in the seventh one, The Supreme One, who is celebrated as the Supreme Being or Supreme Soul, is the supreme source of the cosmic manifestation as well as its reservoir and winding up. Thus he is the supreme fountainhead and absolute truth. Now here he defines what is Ashraya. Param Brahman Paramatma Paramatman Iti Paramatman Paramatma Iti is the supreme Brahman. And is he who is the yataha, the source of abhasa, the sending forth in a way, the cosmic manifestation of light rays coming out of him, and nirodha, it's winding up. So here he describes now the tenth topic, the ashraya, that is to say, the classic definition of the absolute truth. It's another way of saying janmadasya yataha. That from which everything has its origin. Janmadasya yataha, janmadi asya, yat ataha, means its birth, etc. Janma adi. That from which comes birth, etc. means maintenance and destruction. So that's the classic definition here. And Prabhupada says here, it's right there in the beginning, Janmad Yashar Yataha, quoted in the and the Vedanta Taptu Hidas Taptu Advayam. And so then he also puts Krishna to Bhagavan Swayam, the Krishna is that Bhagavan. The original source of all energies, summum bonum, as the absolute truth. Bhagavan is the last word of the absolute truth. And even with the synonyms for Bhagavan, such as Narayan, Vishnu, and Purusha, the last word is Krishna. Then he quotes the Bhagavatam as the sound representation of Krishna. So Prabhupada has said, to explain Krishna or the science of Krishna, the Srimad Bhagavatam has been prepared. And then the first canto, this truth is indicated in the questions and answers by Sutta Goswami and the great sages like Shankara. And in the first and second of the canto, or chapters of the canto, this is explained. The third canto, the subject is more explicit. Fourth, even more explicit. Further emphasized in the summary of the Srimad Bhagavatam in four verses, as we have already discussed, is succinct. Then he goes on like this, explaining how in every canto the Lord is the ultimate summum bonum and ultimate source of all energy, and how he's indicated there one after the other in that way. So that's his explanation. Now we really have a summary of these 10 topics. Now in the text 8, if the previous verse was describing the ashraya, this verse describes the asrita, that which is sheltered. And here it's mentioned in these three divisions. These words will come up later, and they were mentioned earlier in the purport. These three divisions called adi atmika, daivika, and Adi Bhautika. The individual person possessing different instruments of senses is called the Adi Atmic person. That's the embodied living entity. with his senses for action. He's called Adiatma, from the word Atma. And the controlling deity of the senses is called Adidaiva. Every sense has got its controlling deity. The eyes, every single one. This mention that they're all some personified form of those is gathered around Vishnu and Vaikuntha Loka in Brahma season. The embodiment seen on the eyeballs, that means to say the object of what you see when you look at somebody. It's, people really look for esoteric meanings for that. The visible, the gross, you know, the objects of sense perception is called the adibhautik. A person. That is the body or that which is composed of the gross elements and the sense objects, the tan mantras. Remember, the sense objects are considered to be it emits sounds, it has color and shape, it smells good or bad, so on. This is the sense objects. Right?
You mentioned earlier that these three relate to sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic combination.
Yeah, right. They evolve out of the adidaivic is produced out of the mode of goodness, the mind and the controlling deities. Described as coming out of false ego in goodness. And from false ego in passion come the ten set of senses plus buddhi.
Yeah,
the Purusha with his senses, you know. It's actually referring to the Purusha, but he's the one that's got these senses. Yeah. It's the conditioned person. So he's bristling with these senses and looking for a good time. So I said, are you looking for a good time? We had a Food for Life Center. It was a very rough part of town, and right behind the center there were all these, you come up to the center and these prostitutes, you stop at a stop sign and all these prostitutes would come up to your car. They'd leave their car and say, you guys looking for a good time? We say, no, we're Hare Krishnas. Oh, all right. Are you guys looking for a good time? After a while, they just waved. So that's the one who's looking for a good time in the conditioned soul. And then the Adibhauta is really the gross and subtle material elements, the objects of the senses and the gross elements behind them. When we talk about the senses here in this respect, we mean powers. The power of seeing. Now, the power of seeing gets instilled into a certain structure, which is the adibhautik person. We call them eyes, huh? Two eyes. But there's, you know, there's some have more than two. Some have less than two. Some have very primitive eye spots. Fly has, you know, all these eyes. And we talk about the powers of motion. We have legs, but there's all kinds of legs. And you know, a snake has got its power of motion somewhere else. And of course, some entities like these, they have no power of motion whatsoever. It's just shut down entirely. Unless, of course, we see more of the rings. They're not really these particular. We say, you know, for they say yuzhankara, meaning two hands. But they're really the instruments to manipulate. Well, some living entities, they don't have hands, they have pinchers. And the elephant uses his trunk for his kara. Well, in fact, there's a name. What's his name? He has his hand, knows his name. There's some name for an elephant.
The elephant is called
either
Kari or Husky. Huh? The elephant is called either Kari or Husky.
And Husky means?
Husky has hands, but of his hand.
His hand, right, because you see this is hand. Well, anyway, so they are actually, these powers are put into the living entities in different ways. So the senses are really those potencies. So this is what really the world is assembled out of in three classifications. And so then he starts with the controlling summum bonum, the personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada explains this here. But all the controlling deities are manifestations of the Paramatma feature. They exhibit such and such a matter by entering into each and every universe generated by them. He's talking now about Adi Daivika. But still, apparently, there are divisions of the controller and the controlled. For example, in the food controlling department, the controller of food is a person made of the same ingredients as the person who is controlled. Similarly, each and every individual in the material world is controlled by the higher demigods. So this is the Adi Daivika system. We cannot see without light, and the supreme controller of the light is the sun. The sun god is in the sun planet, and we, the individual human beings, or any other being on earth, are all controlled by the sun god as far as our eyes are concerned. So he's the controller here. Similarly, all the senses we have are controlled by superior demigods, who are as much living entities as we are, but one who is empowered while the other is controller. The controlled living entity is called the adiatmic person, and the controller is called the adidaivic person. Now, I don't know this. This is one question we have to answer. I've answered my Vedic research. Who controls the senses of the demigods? Is it Vishnu directly? The whole biology of demigods is a question. They're wired into the universe in a really different way than we are, because of the controlling systems. And apparently their senses are such that if something happens at a distance from their body, they still can sense it. So they have some more degree of pervasiveness. How they do that, I don't know. They really are very different from us. Okay? Anyway, the controlling living entity is the adiatmic. Controlled is the adiatmic, the controlling adidaivic. All these positions in the material world are different fruit of activities. any individual living being can become the sun god, and so on. Everyone, and this thing is to the ultimate controller. That which distinguishes the controller and the control, that is, the material body, is called the Adibhautik Purusha. And he mentions here, in other words, the body is sometimes called Purusha, as confirmed in the Vedic hymn, Savaya Esha Purusha Ananya Rasamayaha. This body is called the Ananda Rasa embodiment, the body that depends on food. What is this, the Taittiriya Upanishad? Yeah. The living entity, which is embodied, does not eat anything, however, because the owner is spirit and essence. But the material body requires replacement of matter for the wearing and tearing of the mechanical body. Anyway, so he just goes on to explain this. So the Supreme Person is different from all three because he's the shelter of all, and all three are coming out of his energies. It's the sum and substance of that. Now you'll see these terms come up again later in this chapter, because we'll get another description of the universal form and these three divisions. It's about the creation of the universal form. That it ends up this way. Finally, let's go to text 9 here. All the above, the three mentioned stages, of different living entities, all the above three mentioned, are interdependent. In the absence of one, another is not understood. So these three things, that they are working together. The living entity in his senses, the materials of which the living entity's body is made out of, and so on, and the controlling deities. They are interdependent. You have to understand what this means. We cannot blink an eye without the god who's in control of eyelashes doing this. We can't to hear, to move our hand, everything is a whole cognitive mechanism at work. But who sees every one of them as the shelter of the shelter is independent of all, and therefore he is the supreme shelter. He's the Atma, and he is the Ashraya. By Ashraya, Ashraya, he is the shelter of himself. In other words, he doesn't take shelter of anyone else. But he's distinguished from the others who are Ashuta, under the shelter of the Supreme. What it's saying. Right? Okay? You clear on that? So the 10 topics and the 10 categories. So 9 categories in one substance. And then those 9 categories are part of the system described as Adibhautik. Adiatmic, Adidaivic. earlier that we've had this thing called Jnana Shakti, Kriya Shakti, and Dravya Shakti. And when Prabhupada comments on those, I don't know which text they are earlier in this canto, when he comments on those, he comments them he describes it as Jnana Shakti powers, and these certain kind of the powers of knowledge. He also describes them as Adhidaiva, the controlling system. Kriya Shakti, which are the powers of action, as the Adhyatma. And Dravya Shakti, Dravya means matter or substance, as the Adhibhava. So really, at least in the purport, these terms have been introduced. But in the text, it says, it talks about Jnana, Kriya, and Dravya Shaktis. So another terminology. So those are the ones for the system of the world. So now we'll put them to use. Yeah?
That's related to Kriya Shakti is
one
of the power of the senses.
Yeah, yeah. Kriya means action, doing something. Or you're doing something only by these powers of the senses, right? Anything else? Other questions? Yeah.
So the demigods in their particular field of influence is practically all knowing.
Yeah. What they know, they know about. It's just like anybody, you know. If you say you get a piece of machinery, you know, in the government, you know, some electrical station, some electrical substation. The guy who runs it, you know, he knows all about it. He like really is into it, how it works, everything. And his little area to function, he has to be practically omniscient. This kind of little area. So the demigods, in the Bible, in one of the letters of St. Paul, the Greek word he uses for these beings is cosmocrates, cosmocrats. You know, we have like bureaucrat, they're cosmocrats. They run all the universe. And somehow or other they're wired into it, their senses are wired or extended in such a way that they are in their own sphere of things, all pervading. In that limited way, they're pervading and aware. It's almost like they had extended bodies. If you say a body is that part of material nature of what you're most immediately conscious of, you have to say they have extended bodies. Whereas the Lord's, since His consciousness is everywhere, the whole universe is body. But they have little areas which they have are like their bodies. Yeah.
Like Krishna explains in that place, describes in the Gita as Prakya Punya Pratamatam, that you know, they attain the heavenly planets, the fallen yogis. So, are all the residents of the heavenly planets demigods and they're responsible?
No, I don't believe so. I think some are just there to goof off and have a good time. There are 30. They say there's 33 crores of demigods. Some people say 33 million, but 33 crores is 330 million. That's a lot for us. I personally asked Prabhupada this question when we were walking and when he was visiting Philadelphia. I said to him, if Krishna is all powerful, why does he need all these demigods to run the universe. The Prabhupada just looked at me and said, you don't know how to run a universe. And I have to admit that's true. But that's how he does it. He does it by the demigods. The example that Prabhupada uses, you know, if you're in a city and you turn a switch and light comes, and you turn a faucet and water comes, you flush the toilet and it goes out, and there's, because there's a whole system there of light and sewage and water and so on. Maybe gas, electricity, heat. So naturally, I mean, there's certain mechanisms, but ultimately there's a department and there's somebody who has to run that department. It's just not totally impersonal. Even if it's to some extent computerized, somebody has to watch the computers and run them. So Prabhupada says, similarly, the universe acts, works in the same way. Another point, if the absolute truth is a person, then why shouldn't there be persons all the way through? Why not have these creators? These demigods, these controllers, I would say, all over the place. We're also persons. You see, what happened is, it used to be in the world that if you look in the record of all people, ancient people, they all believed this, that the whole nature of the universe was populated by these controlling beings. Even in the Greeks, every little stream, every grove of trees, it had its little local deity and things like that. And not only did everybody believe this, but everybody, they report that human beings had regular interactions with these. These are everywhere. These stories are there. Greeks and Now we don't see them anymore. Now it's just a daydream from the infancy, the cradle time of the human race. But the other explanation is, of course, that we don't see them because they're just not visible to us anymore. And as far as the devas, they don't visit here. They used to come down. The Greeks also, they tell these stories and not only intermingle with human beings, but beget children of them, heroes like Achilles and so many were, Helen of Troy were gods and human women. Zeus especially was fond of this stuff. And we see also in the Mahabharata, this is what, there's children like that. The Pandavas are children like that. Well, this is a common kind of an idea all over the place. It doesn't happen anymore. It says during the Maharaj Prithu, even the ordinary person could see the gods. So maybe not everyone could see them, but people saw them, and we know what they look like. You can, a god has three lakshana, three signs. One, the feet, the demigod, the feet don't touch the ground. They're a little bit off the ground. Two, their eyes don't blink. This is mentioned in the Mahabharata. And three, their garlands never wither. Doesn't so you can tell people saw them. Their garlands are always fresh. They don't wither and die.
They have to go down.
I don't know about that. Yeah.
They cannot take anything from the sword.
They cannot what?
They cannot eat anything.
Well, just I know this because of the story of Nalan Damayanti. this is mentioned that, you know, Damayanti was a beautiful princess and she wanted to marry Nala, the prince. But she was so beautiful, all these gods wanted to marry her too. And so at the time of her Swayamvara, all these gods came to her and they changed themselves so they looked exactly like Nala. And you couldn't tell one from the other. But such was her firmness of chastity that in the face of her deep dedication to Nala, the gods were not able to maintain their disguise. And suddenly you could see all of them lifting up off the ground and their eyes not blinking and their garlands fresh. And so she could see who was not. That's the story. And Nalan Damayanti. Yeah. It was in the Sanskrit reader, so I translated it. I learned about the Dalaiyas. Well, but Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati mentions that story as an example of a mundane rasa. But he went to the Mahabharata. So the gods don't come here anymore. There are certain places that tourists don't visit. There used to be lots of tourists in Kashmir. They don't go there anymore. They don't go. You don't see them. They don't go to Sudan. They're not there. They don't go. Right? The gods don't come here. They're not visible anymore. And anyway, so at a certain period of human history, there was this thing that happened. A German sociologist called Entzauberung, the disenchantment of the world, or the de-divininization of the world. And it's a kind of making everything impersonal. Because then, this is part and parcel of the advancement of material science. Because if everything is being controlled by gods, then you have to act one way about the world. But if there are no gods, maybe there's one god way up there, but it's like remote and everything, you de-divinize nature, then it's up for grabs. There's no control. You can start to try to control events and things like that. That's the attitude of modern science. So we live in this world now which has been undergone this historical process. No one sees them anymore. However, if the Sankirtan movement is successful, they'll become visible again.
I don't know what the best that Prabhupada said. The demigods cannot take anything, cannot see anything in this world. Except the ghee in the mouth of Brahma.
Where's the word from demigod?
Huh?
Where's the word demigod from?
Well, Prabhupada uses it. It's looking at OED. The word demi means partial. Deva is just really a god. But Prabhupada uses it to distinguish, so you will not think that they're somehow keep the idea out of your head or on the same or equal. What happened here, man? I got some wrong thing going on. I hit the wrong button. Here it is. Okay. I look up the word demigod in OED. See where it shows up from first.
The word of the day was stupid.
Stupid, right. They don't say much. In ancient mythology, etc. Oh, see, demi is a rendering of the Latin semi-deus. Semi-god. you want to see, you can go see this link here. We can hit Demai, this prefix, and we can see what it means. Various places. It means a single apart, huh? In that way. Now, how do I go back to where I was in this thing?
Entry history.
Here we go. Being partially of divine nature. Well, that's the original usage. A minor or inferior deity, or a man, a mortal race, a divine rank. So the original usage was like that, a god and a demigod. Yeah. So then Prabhupada uses it to distinguish the mini gods from the original god. Even somewhere I saw the usage semi-demigod, because there's devas and there's upadevas, the minor, low level. The word devata means divinity. Devata, he has, godness, divinity. A divinity, sometimes used as a noun too, as a singular, divinity. Devata. Okay?
So it's a contradictory force inside this universe, all the universe.
Who? What?
Contradictory force and devatas, devas.
I don't know. That's 33 crores just in this one. I would suspect, since the other universes are very big and Brahma has more heads, that they probably have more devatas. But I don't know for sure. Anyway, I don't need it. What difference?
I got Adi Vedic and Adi Atman, but Adi Bodhic, like, in relationship to me, like looking at him, he's like an Adi Bodhic.
Adi Bodhic.
Because he's on my eyes balls, right?
Because what you see are the sense objects. And those, and behind those sense objects are the elements that support them of earth, water, fire, air, and space.
Okay. So, in an Adi Vedic perception in relationship to me, it also has to have senses and everything else.
No, he doesn't, because you can have an Adi Vedic impression of this computer also.
So
when it says Adivadik Purusha, then it means really that, that person who are considered as a material body, independent from the living functions supplied by the sensory powers. But the senses are subtle. In fact, they're in the subtle body. The powers of the senses are in the subtle body. It's part of the subtle body, but then they get expressed in a gross body according to the mentality that's there. In other words, the power for smell, that is to say, the desire for smell and somehow be able to do it is there. But you can have a nose like this, or you can have a nose that's way in front of your face like a dog. Or you have a snout, or you have all kinds of noses, or olfactory things. But the sense of taste in a fish is not in the tongue. The fish have a stripe along their side, and then that stripe are taste buds, because they live in water. So their bodies are tongues. And Prabhupada said this about fish. Fish life is all tongue. So for tasting, the fish has got the best body. Because taste, the flavors are conveyed in water. They're the tongue mantra of water, so if they're in water, they're really big at tasting. Yeah. but so that the power of taste is gets embodied in different adibhautic structures, let's say. Because bhautic comes from bhuta. Bhuta means the elements, five growth elements, and then the sense objects that are associated with them. From sound, you'll study this. From sound, we already have. From sound, a certain reaction, then space is manifest. Then there's a transformation. And then after that, the object of the sense of touch are manifested and air. But what comes first is the tongue mantra and then the gross element. Okay, continue tomorrow. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.